Welcome to the Coach's Corner podcast, brought to you by the South Florida chapter of the International Coaching Federation, where our goal is to engage, motivate, and inspire. On the Coach's Corner, we speak with the great professional coaches of ICF South Florida. We hear about what compels them to coach. We talk about the people they support and the tools and techniques that they use to get the job done. Coaching is a hugely specialized craft, and this inside look at the power and the promise of coaching is both an exploration and a celebration of our member coaches, their talents, and their client successes. Hello, I'm Eric Gorris, a member of the ICF South Florida Programming Committee and host of the Coach's Corner podcast. If you're a coach, I'd like to invite you to visit the ICF South Florida website so you can learn more about our chapter's benefits and program offerings. To learn more, go to icfsouthflorida.org. Check out our calendar of events, and if you find an event that interests you, register for free as our guest. Just use the promo code PODCAST. Today we speak with Fiorella Velarde, an emotional intelligence-minded executive coach affiliated with 6 Seconds, who works with Fortune 500 clients and also works as a death doula. You can connect with Fiorella on LinkedIn, but before you do, get to know her here on the Coach's Corner podcast. Fiorella, hello. Thank you so much for being here. How are you doing today?
Oh, I'm doing awesome. Thank you so much for having me here.
We are so happy to have you, Fiorella, and really looking forward to this conversation. Before we get into that, though, I was wondering if you could tell us, what was your journey to coaching? What was it that led you to coaching, or how is it that you became a coach to begin with?
I got to coaching through breakthrough wound, okay? Very challenging in terms of my personal health. I got fibromyalgia. I had a very difficult, complex co-parenting situation. I have a 16-year-old daughter. She was like 5'4" at that time. And so I found myself at crossroads of parenting a child alone. So getting autoimmune disease, number of autoimmune disease being the most visible, I think, or invisible, I would say, fibromyalgia. And so I had chronic pain, and I was at some point, I ended up being in bed for at least 8-12 hours a day, and having to sometimes use a cane to walk, sometimes I will get better. And so I was in that journey, visiting doctors and not knowing how to handle the medical condition. I had always been the kind of person that wanted to know more about the root cause of things. That's also my professional background. It's very interdisciplinary. And I guess that's how it led me to find out more about what was the overall condition, what was in there for, what was the role of emotions, what was the role of my own maybe past family traumas, family background, right? So I ended up embarking in a lifelong journey, really. I have to say that the story ends well. I got into full remission, 100%. After 5 years, I think that because I took action in time, it really didn't, the condition or the cluster of symptoms, they didn't affect my body that much. And I could really bounce back and recover. That was a long answer.
Yeah, but I mean, a fascinating tale of getting to coaching. So how long ago did you start coaching?
10 years ago.
10 years ago. So been there for a while then.
Yeah. Before that, I was facilitating an emotional intelligence and then heart resilience and just talent development, performance in general, right? But the age of coaching came later. After I had already started my journey with emotional intelligence in 6 Seconds, and it was suggested to me, and I was already a regional director for Latin America for 6 Seconds. Honestly, I didn't think I could be a good coach for one better reason, but I really ended up loving it, and I think that's a great call that I'm very happy someone suggested to me. Very grateful.
You say you weren't sure that you could become a great coach. How did you become a great coach?
Before being a coach, I facilitated programs, and I think I was a good teacher and someone that can put complex concepts into simple explanations and energize people. And that's kind of my own personality, right? Coaching had a different implication. For coaching, you have to be a really good listener. And to me, empathy, for instance, was something that it's not a natural world language. It's not something that I learned as a child, even. It's something that I have to build into as I work in my own healing. I was fairly new to emotional intelligence and active listening. So through my journey in coaching, I found out things about that were quite fascinating.
And you mentioned emotional intelligence a couple of times and also 6 seconds, which I want to get back to in a second. But could you tell us just very briefly for those of us who are vaguely familiar with emotional intelligence or maybe not familiar with emotional intelligence, what is emotional intelligence as you would define it?
Emotional intelligence has a number of definitions, right? But I think that 6 seconds, the organization I'm with has a very, very elegant and simple form to present it. And it's just being about being a strategic with your feelings. Right, using emotions as raw material to make better decisions in your life. And beginning with that, I think that when I got into emotional intelligence, it really helped me turn around my health issues. I was very, always feeling everything, always very much into my emotions. It was like quite overwhelming. And that takes a toll in your health, in your life, in your relationships. So I think that a precise definition was quite helpful for me. And it was not about just feelings. It's about strategic decision, role play, purpose, optimism. That's a big one. Recognizing your patterns and so much more.
So it sounds like a healthy dose of self-awareness paired with emotional regulation, sort of. And you had mentioned being, overwhelmed by emotions. And I can see how, and so am I to assume that emotional intelligence is sort of like the intelligent understanding and processing of those emotions so that you're no longer overwhelmed? Is that it?
Yes. Yes. For some people, for instance, for me, I was very self-aware, but it was to a point and it's a calibration game, right? Sometimes too much of a good thing, really not a good thing, right? So to me, I was quite self-aware, quite immersed in my emotions, in my thoughts. So I was stuck. I couldn't move. I was there. I was drowning in my own water. And through 6 seconds and emotional intelligence, what I learned is that there is a way to navigate, not to suppress, not to control, not to put under the rug, right? Not to be stoic, but rather navigate. And just as Susan Davy shows in her research, emotions are part of the contract that we have with life.
That's well put. That's really cool. Emotions are part of the contract we have with life. Yeah, precisely. The human condition, right?
Yeah, and the fine print. So this is in fine print when you sign the contract, right? And the work I do, it's about getting that fine print in the headspace. That's the title. So people know what they're coming into and they really enjoy it. And we lead different lives with better quality.
And you've mentioned 6 seconds a few times already. And I'm wondering if you could tell us sort of what that is and what your relationship is with 6 seconds. And I believe that's also part of your training as well, right?
Absolutely, yes. We have an amazing coaching school, an organization that teaches them about emotional intelligence all over the world. Our practitioners are very committed. We are in all continents. And I lead the Latin American region, 19 countries in the region, plus Brazil.
Awesome. So it's a coaching school. And also, is it also do outreach? And I presume so.
We do so many things. We have a partnership with United Nations for activities, creating awareness for children, families, about emotions and sustainability goals. And we have some other partnerships in education. And we actually even are teaching a PhD and a couple of PhDs on emotional intelligence and education.
Ooh, that's fantastic. That is really cool. Wow, United Nations. That's impressive. And global, of course.
Yeah. We have our assessment has been translated to more than 12 languages.
Fira, let me ask you. So if you could, tell us about the kind of coaching you do and the people that you work with.
So the kind of coaching I'm doing right now, it's executive coaching. And recently someone who were talking about life coaching, executive coaching and all these, and it was brought to my attention, which is really something very wise, that I work with people in an executive setting, but these are people problems. So I mean, the distinction, right? It used to be for me, like, well, I'm not a life, I'm an executive coach. But then, I mean, it was really thinking about this and thinking about the issues, you know, I mean, I have some teams which are like in the menu, those are the to-go teams, right? Of course, everybody is different, but it's, what is it? Time management, right? Which is in reality saying no to some things, to say yes to others, how you handle your own roles. So it's executive coaching at its best, human coaching in executive environment. That's what I would call it.
we get asked that all the time. What do you do? And it's like, well, yeah, I coach executives. But no, they're people, right? People in a different context, the context of the executive setting, or in the context of a career transition, or in the context of being stressed out about a business or a relationship or a situation. Yeah, that's a cool way of looking at it.
Yeah.
Are you working with a lot of executives? What kind of big companies, small companies?
Yes, I work with a bunch of Fortune 500 companies. I have mainly tech, Google, even military, some financial companies, services, big companies. I also coach with BetterUp, very well-known platform. And most of the people that come for coaching have similar problems. I mean, they're unique individuals, but they have similar problems. And it's either burnout, it's either time management. I have a lot of people that come for parenting, like finding work-life balance and quality parenting. And I try to relate a lot to my clients in the human experience. I've been practicing meditation, going to retreat and self-compassion for around 8-10 years that I got certified. So I can meet them where they at. And sometimes I got clients that come to me and say, but what is your special? What is that field that you know so I can accommodate to you? I'm like, well, I mean, we're coaching the person. So it's about asking you the questions and helping you find yourself, right?
And that sounds like a great moment to segue into, you know, your personal style. Would you care to say a few words about your personal coaching style or approach?
I kind of, for me, the way I coach is with my whole self. And I invite people to call in the whole self. That, of course, implies that I have to continuously work on myself and be brave enough to sometimes say, hey, you're not doing this in this way, and track back and do things differently and keep learning. So for me, the way intention is the most clear measurement of action. So if you have intention, you'll have action. The higher your intention, the most effective your action. But sometimes people need more time to find themselves. I strive to go with the client, wherever the client wants to go, and be a thoughtful partner.
I really appreciate what you just said there about the relationship between intention and action and the sort of levels of each of those. Kind of ties it back to the why, or why are we doing this, or what is our motivation. But I like the way it brings in the degrees. High intention, I presumably, leads to high action.
Yes.
And clarity, I assume, is part of that too. Yeah, having that clarity as well, perhaps.
Yeah, And I also coach a lot of female leaders. And I do believe in empowerment, and I believe that self-awareness and coaching gives you the tools for self-empowerment. But I also think that it's important for me in my practice to step into my most compassionate side of empowerment, not just any side of empowerment, but I need to step into my most compassionate side, because I need to see what my biases are, what my judgments are, right? If I'm in the right mind space in that moment, coach, and many other things, because I have a unique human being, a full universe in front of me. So this is not about just empowerment. And sometimes to lead a word can be a little bit dismissive, because it's not seeing the complexity, it's not seeing the struggles that the human that I have in front of me is experiencing.
And in that case, when you're working with someone in leadership, female in leadership, and the struggles come forward, I mean, do you think the female leaders who are coming to you, do you think they know that they're going to be going down that path, that emotional exploration?
I think that most people have much more self-awareness that they really acknowledge. And in a way, it's paradoxical, because the way they explain things might not be that they have the verbal self-awareness, but they have the wisdom in their body. So that's another aspect of my coach. I work with somatics as well. So sometimes they realize how difficult it is to verbalize what you feel, or how easy it is to think your feelings. So I turn it around and I go to the body, to the perception, to how you're experiencing the world through your senses. And I think that people in that context show that they have much more self-aware that they originally.
Okay, interesting. Really good. Okay, I'm tracking with you on that. So somatic, take us through that for those who, if you could explain what the somatic part of that is.
Somatic is bringing the body into the experience, right? But not just move, it's really being aware where the sensations are, how you are perceiving the stimuli outside yourself. And so people cannot describe, but they were able to tell you, oh, I feel fine. Well, fine is not a feeling. Fine is not even emotion. What is it with fine, right? Even a lot of visual imagining, you know, images, I used recollection, analogies, so people can bring and learn to verbalize. Because I think that this is a very strong phrase from Martha Beck. He wrote, the way we think is through our language. And really, sometimes for people, it's so hard to verbalize, right? That it's easier to connect with a previous experience, with a previous analogy, even with a visual image.
So going back to analogies or another place in their history or their experience to sort of allow them to bring up, I guess, what is in them now or what is current? How does it relate to today? That kind of thing?
Yes. What is that state, right? And one of the questions that I normally don't ask is, how are you doing today, right? That's something that I reserve more for social, not in my sessions, because I think that it's not an open-ended question. It's right. And when you go into what is your perception today, you know, or something much more oriented to get a much more articulated answer, people feel they're invited to that and then they reciprocate. And how are you doing today? It's such a question that I guess we're so used to not to give you a direct answer or say just whatever, right?
So then coach, if you're not starting a session with, hi, how you doing? What do you start your sessions with, out of curiosity?
Well, it's basically same phrase in a different way, right? Well, how's, you know, what life has brought you this week? And how's life treating you this week? Or how you are, you know, how's your energy level today?
Uh-huh.
And now, how are you doing today? Because how are you doing today? I find that it's kind of when you get introduced to a group or to someone, and the first thing people ask to you is, what do you do? It's kind of, we got the automatic pilot for that one.
Yeah, that's true. Those are autopilot. Those are autopilot questions. You're right.
Yeah. Yeah. So I go for the energy level. I look around, you know, sometimes the environment where the person is sitting, and I just try to go off and then go back into
it. Fiorella, if I may, there's some stuff here that came up in the, you know, I'm so curious about some other work that you do. I know you do an amount of grief and end of life coaching. Death doula coaching, certification of death doula. I find that fascinating, and I don't want to bury the lead. I'd love to hear more about this if you would care to go into it a bit.
Well, this idea that emotions are extremely helpful strategically, right? But not just the good emotions, or what they're called the good emotions, because in reality, all emotions are helpful and all bring a message, right? But there's this, I had this, this sensation that people, like, really push away this negative, what they call negative, are going to make them feel bad or uncomfortable, right? And back in 2020, I have a loss in family. And as months went by, it was almost the end of the year, I decided on 2021 to pursue this certification in thanatology as a death doula. And I never imagined what brought me into, oh my God, it wasn't much more than I signed for. It was like 6 months of very in-depth exploration, very intensive. You go from anywhere to understanding death at a different level to, you know, hold funerals, arrangements for different kinds of burials, racial difference, disparities also in the way we talk about death and cultural differences. So a lot of sensitivity training, and it was very, very interesting. And I think I went in there because as we signed this contract that we were mentioning, the fine print, I think it's not large enough for us to read that we all go in there. And what I have observed in my practice in sitting with people and sitting with family for the last 2 years is that for the most part, we die the way we live. I see good death and I see very sad death.
That's very profound. And what must be incredibly impactful work. I mean, it sounds amazing. It sounds courageous. It sounds terrifying. It sounds like it would pull every last bit of empathy out of you. It sounds very, very intense, to put it very mildly.
Remember I told you it was difficult for me to listen at the beginning, right? So at the beginning of my journey, it was difficult to listen. It was difficult to stay, right? And years ago, I initiated this journey of learning how to stay when I'm comfortable. I knew that my way through pain, my way with pain was through pain. That was a given. So, but I still resist. And I think that as a doulas, but what we do is we normalize spaces to create these conversations, right? And these conversations are quite uncomfortable, but they're so necessary. The more you lean into the conversation, the more you stay in the uncomfortable, you realize that grief goes along with joy. I once heard this interview, and they were interviewing Brené Brown, and she was saying that the way people deal with joy says a lot about the way they deal with grief. If we are someone that constantly waiting for the other shoe to drop, everything's going great, and we're waiting for the other shoe to drop, it's how we deal with grief. And it's really a complete full of sensations and perceptions that grief gives you. And it's also the idea that we get over grief, and we never get over it. We learn to live with it. I mean, telling that or understanding that is really understanding why a mother keeps grieving after they, you know, she loses a child years, you know, you never forget. It's not about forgetting, it's about overcoming. And I think our culture is so plagued with the messages of trials, of, oh, you're a warrior, you're this. I mean, it's such a patriarchal language. And I thought about my own experience with Father Roger. I didn't want to be a warrior. I was sick precisely because I was at war with myself. I didn't want to be a warrior. So becoming a death doula has been for me the completion of a journey, that aspect of the journey, learning to stay. Okay, I'm here. I'm staying. So I'm waiting for what's coming next.
And so there it is. It all connects back to the beginning.
Yeah.
I can only imagine. I mean, in this kind of work, if you don't mind me going, just continue down this path a little bit. You talked about the conversations that you have. I can only imagine. What are the conversations? I mean, are they even? Can you even characterize them as something?
Absolutely. And they're very, very practical conversations as well, right? Say, advanced directives. What's going to happen? Who's going to take care of what? What is the meaning? Sometimes with the same patient, right? With the same child. It is, what is the meaning of dying for them? What they want their legacy to be? What happens if they need to go to support end of life? Is there any planning with that? How the space for the last days needs to look like? What are the traditions or the rituals they have to incorporate in special moments? Giving support to families. Explain the symptoms. Explain what are the limitations of certain kinds of care, right? In a very different, I mean, this is not overlapping the role of practitioners, nurses, and all the medical personnel. But the sad truth is that most of these people don't get trained on this. And we saw that through COVID. All the burnout, all the exhaustion, all the not knowing how to tell someone that the loved one has passed, you know, in the hospital. So it's a lot of practical conversations, but they have a very, a much more solemn, I will say, edge.
Thank you for taking us through that. Again, it's just a fascinating application of coaching, whose the benefit, I can only imagine how beneficial it is to those that you're working with in this particular line of work. Fascinating. Fiorella, are you working with, I mean, do you start working with someone when they've received a terminal diagnosis, or are you meeting them sort of more at the end at hospice, or when do you start engaging with your clients in this realm?
That's a great question, because I have different kinds of experiences, right? And I also wanted to say that as a death doula and being certified in thanatology and all that, I had also received training to talk about loss and grief, right? And it can be a divorce. It can be a sick relative. It can be an ailing parent. It can be a child with a terminal condition. So those are called, you know, these are longer processes of grief, right? This is anticipatory grief, because you're grieving something that is going to sooner or later happen. And those are very common, much more common than people may imagine. And even losing your job, you know, that's over identification that we have in our culture with what we do, right? You lose your job, who are you? So I had experience where I met people at the beginning of their journey with a terminal disease or at the end of the journey. I recently lost a friend of mine and someone close, and I sat with him for his last days. And this person was very special to me, was definitely my mentor. And this was a very special experience because of the proximity, right? And I felt honored to be there for him. And we did something that I think had to do a lot with the spaces in hospice. This guy was, his first career was a pilot, open sky, love the freedom. And he was too ill to go and to die in Europe as he probably wanted. But we moved his room to a room that was finishing the ocean. He was in a hospice in West Palm. And so for 2 days before he passed, he had a scar right in his face. And then that made me to think about the way we are choosing to die in this country and in our culture in general, right? I also learn about other people that, knowing that the end is imminent, they go and they stay in the grass, right? Or they go. So to what degree these conversations are so crucial for the planning to circumvent these structures sometimes, you know, and then, well, within our regulations, but there's so many things that we're agreeing on, you can really choose how you want to die. And I guess this is what I like to communicate to the people. It's in your power. You can choose.
To that, would you say generally people are unaware of the choices that they may have in front of them at this time?
Yes, yes. I'm sadly unaware. It's a conversation that we have among the doulas. That's one of the main reasons why I also got into this, because I had a sensation that there's not enough information. Something as simple as, say, your loved one passes in the room, you can have 2 hours with the person in the room just to grieve. They don't have to take you out of the room immediately, and they will respect that, right? Most people don't know that. Or sometimes you have even doctors that tell you, oh, take a shower, and you don't get to stay with the person passes, right? Or you can even go with the body to the elevator when they're going to release the body to the mortuary. Some people don't know that. And for some people, that's the key to their closure in that moment. That's not going to end in grief, but it's going to provide closure of that sacred moment of, you know, the person is departing from this world. And this is this idea that birth and death are both sacred moments. Not knowing all these things can make a huge difference from someone when they're grieving.
Does it evoke understanding or acceptance, or what is it, Fiorella? What is it that makes it work? Is it, we can't get rid of grieving. That's true. And nor would we want to, right? Like, I mean, that is, so what is it? Is it then I've made sense of it? I understand it?
I think it evokes some sort of acceptance and gives you that tender self of kinship, right? Is this one of yours that is departing and you're there till the last moment? And this is what I see with people when they get to be with their loved ones, and sometimes, you know, they grab on something and they fix their hair, they fix their body, right? They change them.
Amazing. And it has me thinking, I mean, is this enlightened way of coaching through death or helping people work through death, is that something that is it accelerating in acceptance? Are you finding that this is more and more the case, that people are opening up their minds to processing it in a different way, or are we getting more closed off, do you think?
No, I think that we're still, you know, in a lot of denial. I perceive that still. I think death is being seen like the ultimate failure for some reason, right? As opposed to being seen as something right? It is an honor to be in this world, and you know, the departure should be equally, not to say that, look, I'm a death doula, but it doesn't mean that I'm ready to go or anything like that, right? Like, I like, but it also allows you to put life in perspective, right? And life in perspective and also my work in perspective. It has allowed me to, I think, be a better coach staying with people. I recently, for the coaching week, recently for ICF, I presented a workshop on, you know, where the things that I had learned as a death doula that had improved my coaching.
I can only imagine. Yeah.
Yeah.
Fiorella, that's amazing. And thank you for taking us through that. Like I said, I find that profoundly interesting. And just an amazing application of coaching, as I said. A couple of questions. I guess we'll move on here to sort of final questions. That sounds so funereal, doesn't it, now after this conversation? We talked about the final questions. I don't mean it in that way at all. I just mean the remaining two questions of today's conversation. First off, Fiorella, for those out there who may be interested in connecting with you or working with you, where can they find you and where can they connect with you?
My website and my LinkedIn. My LinkedIn is Fiorella Velarde, just my name and last name. My website, www.fiorellavelarde.org.
Yeah, and we'll make sure to have those in the show notes naturally so we can get a hold of you. You know, one question left, and it's a little bit of a soft pitch, but it's a good one nevertheless. Before we get into that, I just want to thank you, Fiorella, for being here again with us today. Thank you for taking the time, and thank you for showing up and just bringing such an incredibly interesting and compelling conversation. Thank you.
Thanks to you. It's been a great pleasure to be talking to you about these things. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, well, get into the last of it here and then get you back to your day. So, Fiorella, tell me, what do you see when you look into the crystal ball, the future of coaching? What is it that you see?
I think that for coaching, right, for the lay person out there, I never had a coaching experience, never had a coach. Space is opening up. There's much more awareness now in terms of the reach. There are fantastic Slack platforms that are bringing coaching to more and more people. And they're also making it much more inclusive for people like me, you know, female, immigrant, and different backgrounds, right? To enjoy experiences like this and really to be able to grow through it. There are different aspects that I think are very important in specializations, right, in coaching. I see coaching being much more professional savvy. I think the barriers of entry are going to get tougher because we need it, right? We need the training, we need the constant preparation. And also I think that it will branch out in more fields. Like, for instance, psychology, right? I'm a psychologist as well, and I don't practice clinical psychology. But I think that the coaching skills, asking certain questions, motivational interviewing, the way we have to speak to clients, will be very useful for clinicians, health professionals in general. It's very useful. Other fields like wellness coaching. I'm currently doing a certification in wellness coaching in Mayo Clinic. And I see how the intersection of emotional intelligence, coaching, and wellness coaching will be so vital for people in the next 20, 30 years. I mean, we're living longer. We need to see how we live longer in a way that allows us to be vibrant and energetic. And that I'm speaking for myself too.
So the future is bright for coaching.
Very promising, yes.
Fiorella, thank you so much for being here today. Again, it has been a delight. Thank you so much.
Thanks to you and for having me here and for sharing this knowledge. Thank you.
What a great conversation. It's always so educational and inspirational to talk with colleagues and learn from their experiences. That's why it's so important to continue to collaborate with others. And that is one of the best reasons to consider working with a certified coach. Working with a certified coach opens a whole new space to learn, grow, and design your future in a way that you want it. To learn more about what coaching is and how it can help you, please visit our website at icfsouthflorida.org. There you'll find educational resources, our events calendar, and our coaches directory. We hope you'll find exactly what you're looking for, and if you like what you see, consider becoming a member. We would love to welcome you to our community. That's it for now. Thanks again for joining us in the ICF South Florida's Coach's Corner. Until next week, I'm Eric Goris. Take care and be well.